And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the war in Europe between Russia and Ukraine still continues. By all reports, the Russians are taking major casualties, but they got plenty of conscripts to throw at it. Well, this is April 21st, 111th day of the year. 254 days remain till the year's over with. On 753 BC, Romulus, one of the twins, Romulus and Remus, don't you know, allegedly founded Rome. This is a traditional date. 43 BC, Battle of Mutina. Mark Antony's again defeated in battle by Aulus Hirtius, who's killed. Antony fails to capture Mutina, and Decimus Brutus is murdered shortly after this. 900, the Laguna Copperplate inscription is found. That's the earliest known written document in what's now the Philippines. Commander-in-chief of the Kingdom of Tondo is represented by the Honorable Jayadua, Lord Minister of Pilat. Pardons from all debt the Honorable Namwaran and his relations. 1092, the Diocese of Pisa elevates the Metropolitan. Oh, good Lord, Archdiocese by Pope Urban II. The in those days, the Pope's word was the word of God. 1506, the three-day Lisbon massacre comes to an end with the slaughter of over 1,900 suspected Jews by Portuguese Catholics. 1509, Henry VIII ascends the throne of England on the death of his father, Henry VII. 1526, the last ruler of the Lodi dynasty, which is in Afghanistan, Ibrahim Lodi, is defeated and killed by Babur at the First Battle of Panipat. 1615, the Wignacourt Aqueduct is inaugurated in Malta. 1782, the city of Ratanakosin, now known internationally as Bangkok, is founded on the eastern bank of the Chao Phraya River by the King Buddha Yodfa Chula Loki. 1789, John Adams is sworn in as the first U.S. Vice President, 9 days before George Washington became president. 1789, George Washington's reception at Trenton is hosted by the ladies of Trenton as he journeys to New York City for his first inauguration. 1792, Tiradentes, revolutionary leading a movement for Brazil's independence, is hung, drawn, and quartered. I had to teach him not to do it again. 1802, 12,000 Wahhabis sack Karbala, killing over 3,000 inhabitants. Karbala, was a very important city in the first Saudi state. The sack took place under the rule of Abdulaziz bin Muhammad, the second ruler of the first Saudi state. About 12,000 Wahhabis from Najda attacked the city of Karbala. Raid was conducted in retaliation against attacks on Hajj caravans by Iraqi tribes and coincided with the anniversary of Ghadir Khum event, or the 10th Muharram. The Wahhabis killed between 2,000 and 5,000 of the inhabitants and plundered the tomb of Hussein ibn Ali, grandson of the Prophet Muhammad and son of Ali ibn Abi Talib, and destroyed the dome. Seized a large quantity of treasure, including gold, Persian carpets, money, pearls, and guns that had accumulated in the tomb. Most were donations from those who came to worship. The attack lasted for 8 hours, after which the Wahhabis left the city with more than 4,000 camels carrying their plunder. In 1806, the auction of 21st of April, 1806, a French frigate escapes British forces off the coast of South Africa. And that's not auction, but action of April 21st. I can't read my own handwriting. 1809, two Austrian Army Corps are driven from Landshut by 1st French Empire Army, led by Napoleon, as two French corps to the north hold off the main Austrian army on the first day of the Battle of Eckmühl. 1821, Benderai Ali Pasha arrives in Constantinople as the new Grand Vizier of the Ottoman Empire. Remains in power for only 9 days before he got sent into exile. Some folks just don't have good luck. 1836, Texas Revolution, Battle of San Jacinto. I look at Texas forces under Sam Houston defeat troops under Mexican General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. 1856, Australian labor movement. Stonemasons and building workers on building sites around Melbourne march from the University of Melbourne to Parliament House to achieve an 8-hour workday. 1894, Norway formally adopts the Krag Jorgensen bolt action rifles, the main arm in the armed forces. That weapon would remain in service for almost 50 years. There were some of them used in World War II. 1898, Spanish-American War. U.S. Navy begins a blockade of Cuban ports. When Congress issued a declaration of war on April 25th, it declared that a state of war existed from this date. 1914. Ipiranga incident. German arms shipment to Mexico is intercepted by the U.S. Navy near Veracruz. 1918, World War I, German fighter ace Manfred von Richthofen, better known as the Red Baron, is shot down and killed over Vaux-sur-Somme in France on this date. 1926, I think he had 80 kills to his credit. Al-Baqi Cemetery, former site of the mausoleum of the four Shia imams, is leveled to the ground by the Wahhabis. The Wahhabis were a Sunni revivalist and fundamentalist movement associated with the reformist doctrines of the 18th century. Arab Islamic scholar, theologian, preacher, and activist Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab. He established a movement in the region of Najd in Central Arabia. This movement had a particular emphasis on purging practices such as the veneration of Muslim saints and pilgrims into their tombs and shrines. And pilgrimages to their tombs and shrines, which are widespread among the people. 1920, they wanted a purity of the first three generations to rid Muslims of inauthentic outgrowths. Oh, since it's a late come religion, who knows? 1934, the surgeons photographed the most famous photograph allegedly showing the Loch Ness Monster is published in the Daily Mail. 1994, it was allegedly shown to be a hoax. 1945, World War II, Soviet forces south of Berlin at Zossen attacked the German High Command headquarters. 1948. United Nations Security Council Resolution 47 relating to the Kashmir conflict is adopted. 1952, Secretary's Day, now Administrative Professionals Day, is first celebrated. It was thought that the calling it Secretary's Day was demeaning to the secretaries. That's like janitors are now maintenance engineers. 1958, United Airlines Flight 736 collides with a U.S. Air Force jet fighter near Arden in Nevada in what's now the Enterprise, Nevada. 1960, Brasilia's capital, is officially inaugurated. At 9:30 in the morning, the three powers of the Republic are simultaneously transferred from the old capital of Rio de Janeiro to Brasilia. 1962, Seattle's World's Fair opens up. Now, it was Century 21 Exposition, don't you know? It's the first World's Fair in the U.S. since World War II. 1963, the first election of the Universal House of Justice is held, marking its establishment as the supreme governing institution of the Bahia faith. 1964, a Transit 5BN satellite fails to reach orbit after launch as it re-enters the atmosphere, 2.1 pounds of radioactive plutonium in its SNAP RTG power source is widely dispersed. 1965, the 64-65 New York World's Fair opens for its second and final season. 1966, the Rastafari movement, Haile Selassie of Ethiopia visits Jamaica. An event is now celebrated as Grenadian Day. 1967, a few days before the general election in Greece, Colonel George Papadopoulos leads a coup d'etat, establishing a military regime that lasts for 7 years. 1972, astronauts John Young and Charles Duke fly Apollo 16's Apollo lunar lander to the moon's surface. That's the fifth NASA Apollo program crewed lunar landing. 1975, Vietnam War. President of South Vietnam, Nguyen Van Thieu, flees Saigon as unlocked. The last South Vietnamese outpost blocking a direct North Vietnamese assault on Saigon falls to the communist. 1977, Annie opens on Broadway. 1982, baseball. Raleigh Fingers of the Milwaukee Brewers becomes the first pitcher to record 300 saves. 1985, the compound of the militant group The Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord surrenders to federal authorities in Arkansas after a two-day government siege. 1987, the Tamil Tigers are blamed for a car bomb that detonates in the Sri Lankan capital city of Colombo, killed 106. 1989, the Tiananmen Square protest of 89. In Beijing, around 100,000 students gather in Tiananmen Square to commemorate Chinese reform leader Hu Yaobang. 1993, the Supreme Court in La Paz, Bolivia sentences former dictator Luis Garcia Meza to 30 years in jail without parole for murder, theft, fraud, and violating the Constitution. Hell, if that was done here, we'd have every leader in prison. 2004, five suicide car bombers target police stations in and around Basra, killing 74 and wounding 160. 2010, the controversial Kharkov Pact, that's the Russian-Ukrainian naval base for gas treaty, is signed in Kharkov, Ukraine by Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, unilaterally terminated by Russia March 31, 2014. 2012, two trains are involved in a head-on collision near Sloterdijk in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, injuring 116. 2014, the American city of Flint, Michigan, switches its water source to the Flint River, beginning the ongoing Flint River crisis, which caused lead poisoning in up to 12,000 people, and 15 deaths from Legionnaires' disease, ultimately leading to criminal indictments against 15 people. Five of whom were charged with involuntary manslaughter. 2019, eight bombs explode at churches, hotels, and other locations in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday. More than 250 people are killed. 2021, Indonesian Navy submarine KRI Nanggala sinks in the Bali River during a military drill. Kills off 53 people on board. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances, Abdicalis, Anastasius Sinaita, Anselm of Canterbury, Bueno Conrad of Farsum, Holy Infant of Good Health, Shimon Bar Sabe, Wobodo, Civil Service Day in India, Grenadian Day in Rastafari, Heroic Defense of Veracruz Day in Mexico, Pang Pan Sok's birthday in North Korea, Kartini Day in Indonesia, Local Self-Government Day in Russia, National Tea Day in the UK, National Tree Planting Day in Kenya, San Jacinto Day in Texas, Queen's Official Birthday in the Falkland Islands, Tiradentes Day in Brazil, and Vietnam Book Day in Vietnam. Let's see what else we have. I know we got some other stuff. Okay. 1863? No, that's not right. /9:53, Otto the First, also known as the Great, gives Utrecht fishing rights. 1420, Treaty of St. Martin's Dyke. 1453, Turkish fleet sinks ship's Golden Receiver in Constantinople. 1521, the Battle of Villalar. Emperor Charles I defeats the Communards. 1536, lawyer and statesman Thomas Cromwell begins to plot Anne Boleyn's downfall while pretending to be sick. 1572, France and England signs an anti-Spanish military covenant. 1649, Maryland's Toleration Act passed in the American colony, allowed freedom of worship for Christians, but sentenced to death anybody who rejected the divinity of Jesus. 1654, England and Sweden signed a trade agreement. 1689, William III and Mary Stuart are proclaimed King and Queen of England. 1739, Spain and Naples, Austria signed a peace accord. 1785, Catherine II of Russia confers on the nobility the charter to the nobility, increasing the power of the landed oligarchs. 1794, New York City formally declares the coast of Ellis Island is publicly owned. They did that so they could build forts to protect New York City from the British. 1796, Napoleon and the French defeat the Piedmontese at the Battle of Mondovi. 1820, Danish scientist Hans Christian Oersted, the first one to identify electromagnetism. He came up with the idea while he watched a compass needle. 1855 saw the first train cross the Mississippi River's first bridge from Rock Island, Illinois to Davenport, Iowa. 1857, Alexander Douglas patents the bustle of all things. 1863, Baha'u'llah, founder of the Bahá'í faith, enters the Garden of Rivdin near Baghdad, makes his declaration as a messenger of God during the 12 days he spent there. On this day in 1865, Abraham Lincoln's funeral train left Washington. 1878, the First Lady at the time, Lucy Hayes, begins an egg rolling contest on the White House lawn. Also that same year, New York installed the first firehouse pole. 1878, the ship, the Azor, leaves Charleston with 206 blacks bound for Liberia. 1884, Potter's Field is reopened as Madison Park. 1905, the elected assembly of Crete proclaims a union with Greece. 1908, American polar explorer Frederick Cook claims to have been the first person to reach the North Pole on this particular date. And that is disputed, of course. 1913, the German passenger ship Imperator runs aground. 1916, the Odd, carrying a cargo of 20,000 rifles to assist Irish Republicans in staging what would become the 1916 uprising, is captured by the British Navy and forced to sail toward Cork Harbor. 1930, a fire at the Ohio State Penitentiary kills 322. 1935, a man with a great deal of foresight, King Boris of Bulgaria, forbids all political parties. 1941, World War II, Greece surrenders to Nazi Germany. 1945, on this date, Allied troops occupy the German nuclear laboratory. Also in 45, Hiroshima, Okinawa, conquered in 5 days at the cost of 5,000 casualties. 1945, Soviet Army arrives at the outskirts of Berlin. On that same date, U.S. 7th Army reaches Nuremberg. 1954, Georgi Malenkov becomes the Premier of Russia. 1954, the U.S. Air Force flew a French battalion to Vietnam. 1961, the French army revolts in Algeria. 1967, Joseph Stalin's daughter Svetlana Aliyeva arrives in New York City after defecting to the U.S. 1976, the swine flu vaccine entered testing on this date. I remember we were forced to take it at gunpoint. I was in the military at that time. Armed MPs arrived to make sure we went and got our vaccinations. 1977, Zia-ur-Rahman appointed president of Bangladesh. 1981, U.S. furnished $1 billion in arms to Saudi Arabia. 1982, Dr. Michael E. Bakey performed the first successful heart implant.
That pretty much takes care of our little history segment for today. Now, we've been talking about a lot of strange things. And people send me emails suggesting new topics. I do not ignore them. But somebody sent an email that was very interesting. And started me looking at some topics I hadn't looked at in quite some time. It seems the Lewis and Clark expedition had several purposes.
when the Pope wrote his pronouncement about taking over the lands of other countries, he said it could be done as long as there was no other Christian organization. If it was a religion that didn't follow Christian teachings, you know, their land was free game. Now, one of the things Lewis and Clark were supposed to do is see, as they explored, was there any other society on this continent that would fall under the category of Christian. Now, as you may know, if you know anything about your history, Meriwether Lewis was murdered later. And his murder marked the inception of an academic war over how to define the America that existed before the Spanish conquistadors, the French explorers, and the British adventurers arrived in the New World. And this battle has been going on for centuries by two factions of scholars, the diffusionist and the independent inventionist. Now, to this day, in mainstream academic circles, the diffusionists are spoken of with derision, because as they dig into the past with the same courage that characterized Lewis and his journey west. And like Lewis, these rogue scholars continue to unearth evidence that America was visited long before Columbus by explorers crossing both the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans. And these scholars continue to unearth evidence of rich, vibrant, highly evolved cultures that existed in ancient America. And this growing volume of archaeological evidence is in clear contradiction to many key assumptions held by America's founders and their scholarly counterparts, the so-called independent inventionist. Now, the inventionist perspective remains the standard among archaeologists, suggests that natives of the American continent are descended from Ice Age relatives who crossed the Bering Strait and developed in complete isolation until they were discovered, don't you know, by the Spanish and the French and the British explorers during the late 15th century. And in the early days of America, it was the federal government's proponents who were most interested in characterizing the continent as an untrammeled paradise populated by savages. And this set of assumptions gave early explorers and exploiters the American continent a justification they needed to co-opt and pillage its resources, wage war on its native people, and generally occupy its lands with impunity. It was the perspective of America's government officials held that as they tamed America's terrain and battled its people for control of the resources that would fuel the creation of their new world. And this was also the perspective that was later adopted by the Smithsonian Institution, which more than any other organization has defined our understanding of Americans' origins, even if it meant suppressing archaeological finds. Now, since its inception in the 1800s, Smithsonian joined the powers in Washington in vigorously promoting the idea America was an untouched landscape before Europeans arrived to claim it. Simply put, the Smithsonian initial administrators followed the direction already chosen by America's early leaders, supported by their own inherited culture and scholarly myopia. And paradoxically enough, it was an agent of the Smithsonian Institution, Matthew Sterling, who championed one of the first contentious examples of cultural diffusion when he began investigations into the mysterious Olmecs and the origins of the Mayan culture in what's now the southern reaches of Mexico. Now, the Olmecs are considered by many to be the mother culture to the Mayan, the Aztec, and the Incas. A pre-Columbian people, they inhabited the lowlands of south-central Mexico in a region now occupied by the states of Veracruz and Tabasco. The Olmec were prominent from 1200 BC to about 400 BC, according to various studies. They were the first Mesoamerican civilization and planted seeds of other civilizations throughout that region. They're credited with being the first Mesoamerican culture to practice ritual blood sacrifice and play the Mesoamerican ball game. Practices that became the hallmark of several subsequent tribes and civilizations. From the steamy jungles of Mexico's southern Gulf Coast to the modern countries of Guatemala, Honduras, Belize, Costa Rica, and El Salvador, the Olmecs built large settlements, established trade routes, and developed religious iconography and rituals. Now, the rise of the Olmec civilization was driven largely by the region's ecology, which included well-watered alluvial soil and a network of rivers that provided the Olmecs with a useful transportation system. The region where Olmec culture took root is similar to other cultural spawning grounds such as the Nile, the Indus, and the Yellow River valleys. And this rich environment fostered a dense population and the rise of an elite culture that exploited the region's stores of obsidian and jade, for example, to create artworks of art that have defined the Olmec culture. Exploration of this culture was sparked by artifacts circulating through the pre-Columbian art market in the late 19th and early 20th century. In fact, to this day, Olmec artwork is considered among the most ancient American, among ancient America's most marvelous achievements. Now, archaeologists considered San Lorenzo the earliest of the major Olmec ceremonial centers, located in the open country around the Rio Chiquito in the southern Veracruz. It rested on a massive sculpted salt plateau with a series of man-made ravines constructed on three sides of it. This structure represents the earliest ball court in Mesoamerica, complete with a system of carved stone drains. Now, Richard Deal, professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama, has conducted archaeological investigations all over Mexico and authored the essential guide on the Olmecs. He says San Lorenzo shows clear evidence of class structure and probably a number of different populations forming groups that rose and fell over time and shifted alliances. Doesn't appear to be any political integration. And while he admires their drains and class structure, he makes very little mention of the Olmec's dramatic end, which has been explained away by theories of an internal uprising, ecological disaster, and maybe even a hostile invasion. When San Lorenzo was discovered, almost all its large sculptures were defaced, buried, or destroyed. And like Meriwether Lewis, the Olmec people met a mysterious end that's yet to be satisfactorily explained. Now, some of the carved works at San Lorenzo include the legendary massive Olmec head sculptures that weigh as much as 40 tons and stand nearly 3 meters high. These massive heads have puzzled archaeologists since their discovery, showing characteristics that have led many to assert their African in origin were created by people of African descent. First discovered by plantation workers, these colossal sculptures were reported in the 1869 Bulletin of the Mexican Geographical and Statistical Society as a magnificent sculpture with, most amazingly, representing an Ethiopian. The report included a drawing clearly outlining the Stonehead's African features. And what appears to be a bit of honest investigative reporting was too controversial to be taken seriously at the time. And the very idea of Africans residing in Mexico was quickly and largely forgotten. Now, decades later, Smithsonian curator Matthew Sterling, fascinated by dusty tomes pulled from the basements of the museum, began a personal exploration into the history of the Olmecs. At that point in time, his findings were considered blasphemous by an academic community dedicated to the study of Mayan culture. Now, until his investigation in the late 1930s and early 1940s, Mayan culture was considered the seed of all culture in Mesoamerica. Work by such archaeologists as Philip Drucker and Robert Hetzer, who used modern methods such as carbon dating to determine the age of the Olmec artifacts, later vindicated Sterling and his views. And though they're not widely acknowledged, Sterling's discoveries, publications, and perseverance in defending them would undermine a position long held by his own organization. According to Kathy O'Halloran in Indigenous People's History, the outcome of the Olmec-Maya controversy is noted in the intellectual community as a shining example of the need for an open mind. Above all, it shows how major new archaeological discoveries can be made even in the mid-20th century and how the intellectual perseverance of a minority viewpoint in the archaeological community can lead to eventual acceptance, even after initial rejection. In fact, in my humble experience, some of the most closed-minded people I've ever met are archaeologists. After years of research, in 1938, Sterling traveled to the southwestern Mexican lowland armed with a well-prepared journal and funds from the National Geographic Society. He had a very simple goal: uncover the seeming mystery of a discarded ancient people. His first stop was Tres Zapotes, an ancient Olmec city on the western edge of the Los Tuxtlas Mountains. It's best known for its impressive garden of carved stelas, altars, and the colossal stone heads, all of which were discovered at least 100 miles away from the nearest source of the stone from which they were carved. Among the monuments at Tres Zapotes was Stela C, a freestanding stone monument carved from basalt. Stela's engraved with an undecipherable script which surrounds a jaguar sitting on a throne. On the opposite side of that stela is the second oldest Mesoamerican long count calendar date ever to have been unearthed. That calendar is a non-repeating vestigial based on factors of 20, numerical system, apparently used by several Mesoamerican cultures, most notably the Mayans. They also discovered an imposing 14-foot-high stela with carvings that showed an encounter between two tall men, both dressed in elaborate robes and wearing elegant shoes with turned-up toes. Erosion or deliberate mutilation had defaced one of the figures. The other was completely intact. And it obviously depicted a Caucasian male with a high-bridged nose and a long-flowing beard that the bemused archaeologist christened Uncle Sam. These monuments, whether they resembled bearded Caucasians or African kings, have amazed and bewildered experts and lay people for generations. Graham Hancock, who writes some fascinating books, he's an enclaved alternate historian who was intrigued by the anomalies associated with the Olmecs. He went to the ruins at La Venta, a civic and ceremonial center, home to one of the oldest pyramids in Mesoamerica. He was dumbfounded by the intense complexity of the structures. He wrote, in the center of the park, like some magic talisman, stood an enormous gray boulder, almost 10 feet tall, carved in the shape of a helmeted African head. Well, this was the first mystery of the Olmecs, a monumental piece of sculpture more than 2,000 years old. It was unmistakably the head of an African man wearing a close-fitting helmet with a long chin strap. The lobes of the ears had plugs in them. The entire face was concentrated above thick, down-curving lips. It'd be impossible for a sculptor to invent all the different combined characteristics of an authentic racial type. And a portrayal of an authentic combination of racial characteristics therefore implied strong that there had been a human model. The head was 22 feet in circumference, weighed 19.8 tons, stood 8 feet tall, carved out of solid basalt rock, and displayed clearly an authentic combination of racial characteristics. It was Hancock's view that the Olmec heads present us with physiologically accurate images of real individuals. Charismatic and powerful African men whose presence in Central America 3,000 years ago has not yet been explained by scholars. He also personally studied the same stela that Sterling had studied 60 years before, and he said two things were clear to him. The encounter seen and portrayed must, for some reason, have been of immense importance to the Olmecs. That's why the stela was so grand, and the construction of the remarkable stockade of columns built to contain it. And as in the case of the African heads, it was obvious that the face of the bearded Caucasian man could only have been sculpted from a human model. One was carved in low relief on a heavy, roughly circular slab of stone about 3 feet in diameter. Dressed in what looked like tight-fitting leggings, his features were those of an Anglo-Saxon. Had a full, pointed beard and wore a curiously floppy cap on his head. And around his waist was tied a flamboyant sash. Now, these Caucasian figures carved in the stones were uncovered from exactly the same strata as the huge Olmec heads. Now, the Venta figures in their attire resemble reliefs in Abydos, Egypt, that depict the Battle of Kadesh. Hittite charioteers shown in the relief all have the long, elaborate robes and shoes with turned-up toes. He said, "It's by no means impossible. These great works preserve the images of peoples from a vanished civilization which embraced several ethnic groups. Strangely, despite the best efforts of archaeologists, not a single solitary sign of anything that could be described as the development phase of Olmec society has been unearthed anywhere in Mexico. These amazing artists appear to have just come from nowhere. And evidence does suggest that rather than developing slowly, the Olmec civilization emerged all at once, fully formed. Transition period from primitive to advanced society appears to have been so short it baffles modern anthropologists, archaeologists, and historians. Technical skills that would have taken hundreds or even thousands of years to evolve are brought into use almost overnight, and with no apparent antecedents whatsoever. A vivid picture of the end of the Olmec civilization is found in the ancient city of Monte Alban. The city stands on a vast, artificially flattened hilltop overlooking Oaxaca. It consists of a huge rectangular area enclosed by groups of pyramids and other buildings that are laid out in precise geometrical relationship to one another. According to Hancock, he made his way first to the extreme southwest corner of the Monte Alban site, and there stacked loosely against the side of a low pyramid were the object he came to see, several dozen engraved stelae depicting Africans and Caucasians equal in life, equal in death. In Monte Alban, though, there seemed to be carved in stone a record of the downfall of these civilizations. It did not look as if there could be the work of the same people that made the La Venta sculptures. Standard of craftsmanship was far too low for that. Whoever they were, these artists had attempted to portray the same subjects that he had seen at La Venta. There, the sculptures reflected strength and power and vitality. Here, they were corpses. All were naked, most were castrated, and some were curled up in fetal positions as though to avoid showers of blows. Others were just sprawled. In an annual conference of the Institute for the Study of American Cultures, Mike Zhu, a professor of modern languages and literature at Texas Christian University, suggests the possibility of direct Chinese influence on the Olmec. He said carved stone blades found in Guatemala dating from about 1100 BC are distinctly Chinese in pattern, share uncanny resemblances to glyphs from the Shang Dynasty. Problem isn't whether Asians reached Mesoamerica before Columbus. The problem is when did they arrive and what did they do? Any proposal that smacks of diffusionism in today's academic climate is immediately dismissed as irresponsible at best and malevolent at worst. Here all these American scholars speak in European languages and they dare to say, no, there never was any diffusion, and yes, all Western Hemisphere cultures are indigenous. And certainly, even the newest researcher can tell that's not true. In his book, The Olmecs, America's First Civilization, Richard Deal wrote more than 200 pages, but spent only a couple of paragraphs discussing the possibility that there was diffusion involved in the forming of the Olmec culture. With one entry, he swiftly dismisses all theories and evidence of transoceanic contact. And it's important to note how difficult it is to determine what a bona fide Old World artifact would be, since Old World and New World articles are often indistinguishable. And he offered no new information on the cultures from which the Olmecs could have derived. For the Olmecs to actually be African, not just look like them, they'd almost certainly have come from the isthmus of Tehuantepec via ship. But such voyages are dismissed immediately by most scholars, and the Olmecs have simply been characterized as being local in nature. While excavating in the Mexican state of Veracruz in 2006, archaeologist Maria del Carmen Rodriguez discovered a stone slab with a 3,000-year-old writing previously unknown to scholars. That slab was also covered in carved symbols that appeared to be those of a complex writing system. According to her, finding a hitherto unknown writing system is rare. One of the last major ones to come to light, scholars say, was the Indus Valley script, recognized from excavations in 1924. And now scholars are tantalized by a message in stone in a script unlike any other in a text they can't read. They're excited by the prospect of finding more of this writing and eventually deciphering it in order to crack open a window in one of the most enigmatic ancient civilizations. The inscription on the Mexican stone with 28 distinct signs, some of which are repeated for a total of 62, is been tentatively dated to about 900 BC, maybe even earlier. That's 400 or more years before writing was known to have existed in Mesoamerica, the region from central Mexico through which much of Central America and by extension, anywhere in the hemisphere. Previously, no script had been associated unambiguously with the Olmec culture, which flourished along the Gulf of Mexico and Veracruz and Tabasco, well before the Zapotec and Maya people rose to prominence elsewhere in the region. Until now, the Olmecs are primarily known for the colossal stone heads they sculptured and displayed at monumental buildings in their ruling cities. Several paired sequences of signs have prompted speculation the text may contain couplets of poetry. Experts who have examined the symbols on the stone slab said they'd need many more examples before they could hope to decipher and read what's written. It appeared that the symbols in the inscription are unrelated to later Mesoamerican scripts, suggesting this Olmec writing might have been practiced for only a few generations and may never spread to surrounding cultures. Beyond advanced linguistics and literary systems, the Olmecs also seem to possess advanced knowledge of mathematics and navigation. Gordon Cooper, the astronaut, became interested in the Olmecs during his final years with NASA. During a treasure hunting expedition to Mexico, he encountered Olmec ruins, which led to a startling discovery. According to what he wrote, one day, accompanied by a National Geographic photographer, they landed in a small plane on an island in the Gulf of Mexico. Local residents pointed out to him pyramid-shaped mounds, which they found ruins and artifacts and bones. On the examinations back in Texas, the artifacts were determined to be 5,000 years old. When they learned the age of the artifacts, they realized that what they'd found had nothing to do with 17th century Spain. So he contacted the Mexican government, was put in touch with the head of the National Archaeological Department, Pablo Bush Romero. Together with some Mexican archaeologists, the two returned to the site. After some excavating, according to Cooper, the age of the ruins was confirmed. 3000 BC, compared with other advanced civilizations, relatively little was known about the Olmecs. Engineers, farmers, artisans, and traders, the Olmecs had a remarkable civilization. It is still not known where they originated. Among the findings that intrigued them the most were celestial navigation symbols and formulas which, when translated, turned out to be mathematical formulas used to this day for navigation. And accurate drawings of constellations, some of which wouldn't be officially discovered until the age of modern telescopes. So if they weren't navigating celestially, why have celestial navigation signs? And he said if somebody had helped the Olmecs with this knowledge, from where did they get it? The enigmas left behind by the Olmecs are staggering. Stark contrast to nearly every assumption held about the pre-Columbia cultures, much evidence suggests that people from distant civilizations arrived on the continents supposedly discovered by explorers such as Lewis centuries before. So the question is, can a similar influence be found in North America? And if it can be, did it still exist during the journey made by Lewis and Clark? Well, keep in mind that Lewis wasn't the first intrepid adventurer to suffer a dark fate while discovering secrets on the American continent. 1508, 16 years after Columbus's first voyage, Juan Ponce de Leon discovered gold on the island of Puerto Rico. In a short span of time, the people of the island paradise were no more. Many died in battle defending their homeland. Others succumbed to disease incurred during their enslavement by the foreign invaders who came to exploit rich stores of gold ore and other precious resources. Like Lewis, his discoveries made Ponce de Leon an instant celebrity and one of the richest men in the world. Well, coming from a slightly less glorious early career than Meriwether Lewis, de Leon had begun his naval career as a pirate for hire, attacking ships belonging to the Moors. This experience earned him a chance to undertake a journey to the Americas at the same time Christopher Columbus was making his second trip to the New World, to the West Indies, as part of a costly excursion financed by the King and Queen of Spain. De Leon sailed from the port of Cadiz, arrived on a Caribbean island dubbed Hispaniola, composing the island that's now the host of the Dominican Republic and Haiti to begin his own explorations. Like Meriwether Lewis, Ponce de Leon was a fearless adventurer who reveled in the chance to serve his superiors by exploring the American continent in search of riches. His arrival at Hispaniola marks the explorer's first connection with the region alleged to host the Fountain of Youth. So you have to ask yourself, was this where Ponce de Leon first heard of the fabled well? Or had he already been exposed to that legend during his days of looting Moorish ships? Today, preserved in Ahamiado is the oldest known story that mentions the mythical fountain. It's a poem written by the Muslims in an encoded language. It's called Iskandar al-Quarnine, and it means Alexander the Two-Horned in Arabic. It tells the story of Alexander the Great going to the land of darkness to find the Fountain of Youth. It is possible that the Leon was aware of these tales through his exploration of Moorish and Muslim customs. The fountain was also mentioned as part of the apocryphal letter of Prester John that appeared in 1165 in Europe. 300 years later, in a world unlike anything they could have imagined, the Spanish explorers may have been enticed by similar legends told by Ireland natives. The exuberance enjoyed after the discovery of new lands could easily encourage Leon to believe that anybody could find this legendary fountain, it'd be him. After drifting past the Bahamas and the Florida Keys, he made landfall on the North American mainland, which he mistakenly believed to be an island. Thinking he was still in the Caribbean, he dropped anchor and went ashore somewhere north of what would become the city of St. Augustine. 1514, he returned to Spain to report his findings. The Fountain of Youth was somewhere in those lush isles, he asserted, and the king and queen were convinced that Leon could find it. On his next excursion, he sailed with 200 men and enough supplies to establish a colony. He landed on the west coast of Florida near what would become Charlotte Harbor and was attacked by Calusa Indians. The poison arrow wounded the Leon, and most of the Spanish soldiers and colonists were killed. Like Lewis, his appetite for adventure and exploration led to his untimely death. Few survivors of the skirmish at Charlotte Harbor retreated to Cuba, where De Leon died of his wounds a month later. Coincidentally, in his initial discovery and in his last battle, he had crept within a short distance of lush areas of the deep freshwater sources in Florida. One's near the city of St. Augustine, another near Zephyr Hills. The site of his last battle with the natives was a short distance away from the warm mineral springs in Northport, Florida. These springs run 2,000 feet deep. Despite the gruesome scuffle and the death of Leon, the search for the Fountain of Youth continued. The Spanish conqueror and explorer, Panfilo de Narvaez, attempted an expedition from Cuba, what was called a hurricane. The fleet of ships he was leading was destroyed, and the survivors washed ashore near modern-day Tampa Bay. Only a man by the name of Cabeza de Vaca and 30 companions survived. Their intention was to reach a Spanish settlement in Mexico and regroup there, but after a battle with hostile natives, they built a raft and rafted away into southwestern Texas. Traveling west along the Colorado River, De Vaca and the survivors of that ill-fated expedition became the first Europeans to see a bison. De Vaca returned to Spain 9 years later and published his story, and it became a bestseller for the time. In it, there were references to encounters with giants, which coincidentally was a recurring theme in Native American folklore. Also, some of his tales mentioned an encounter during a raid. He said, when he attempted to cross the large lake, we came under heavy attack from many giant Indians concealed behind trees. Some of our men were wounded in this conflict, for which the good armor they wore did not avail. Indians we've seen so far were all archers. They go naked, are large of body, and appear at a distance like giants. They are of admirable proportions, very spare, and of great activity and strength. The bows they use are as thick as the arm, of 11 or 12 palms in length, and when they discharge at 200 paces with so great precision, they don't miss. 1539, Hernando de Soto sailed 9 ships into Tampa Bay. As they ventured inland, they encountered the friendly Timucuans. Customary for the explorers to ensure their safety by holding captive the tribal chiefs. This was done diplomatically, of course, as an invitation. After some reluctance, the chiefs agreed to become De Soto's guest. When the natives realized becoming guests meant being turned into slaves, the local tribes, led by Chief Cupafi of the Apalachee, sparked an uprising.
After weeks of warfare, the chief was finally captured in a battle near what would become Tallahassee, and he was described as a man of monstrous proportions. Some of the legends of giants and the search for the Fountain of Youth are being cast in new light thanks to the work of researcher Dwayne McCullough. He's found different rock islands within Key Largo that contain springs that are unique in composition thanks to exposure to abundant amounts of nutritious sea salt. These concentrations are attributed to tidal pressure and seasonal freshwater flushings from the Everglades, collecting and mixing within the aquatic pathways that run through cracks in the coral bedrock of the Upper Florida Keys. His research suggests that these rare sea salts contain traces of gold, which is generally greatly diluted in seawater. Because gold could have been concentrated as a salt by the evaporation of seawater nearby Florida Bay and further collected as a heavy metal at the bottom of other basin-like lagoons, it could have been mixed into the local spring waters of the area. This discovery, together with a new understanding of the health benefits of dietary gold salts and how they can improve cell memory, sheds new light on the old legends of waters that impart immortality. Nutritious salts are common in almost all the briny lagoons in the Caribbean. Sulfur, which bonded to a metallic element, creates salts such as calcium sulfate, sodium sulfate, potassium sulfate, which are essential tissue salts found in any healthy body. Science has discovered these tissue salts and several other important salt compounds are useful in maintaining proper health. If they're not supplied as part of our daily diet, the process of aging actually accelerates. Well, we've come to the end of today's show. We're going to be talking more about what has been referred to as the hidden history of America in our next show. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.